Good morning. How many of y'all here saw the blockbuster movie Slumdog Millionaire? A few of you out there saw it. Slumdog Millionaire is an interesting movie about how a kid from the slums of Mumbai, Jamal, finds his way onto the game show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and it just so happens that he knows every one of the questions leading up to winning the 20 million rupees. And in the process of that, the show's producer and the local police think there's something going on here, because there's no way that this kid could know the answers to all of these questions. And so they pull him off before the final question, bring him in, begin to torture him and interrogate him to try to find out how he knows these questions. The movie opens with this scene.
Name.
Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Are you ready?
In many ways, the movie never answers that question. How did he know all these things? As the movie reveals how the interconnection of his life is woven together to really give this kid an answer to every question that comes up on the quiz, is this something that was fate? It is written? And if that's the case, who's the author of the story? Like, who is the one who would write this life? I don't know about you, but that particular question is such a critical question for us to ask and answer, because it has to do with our lives. When you look at your life, you ask the question, is my life divinely ordained? Is there a grand plan? Is there something taking place to shape my life? That will make a huge difference in how you live. Now, I want to start with one of those questions, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire question. I actually put it on the bottom of your outline, so if you'll grab your outline, pull it out. This is the tick, 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 million-dollar question this morning. Now, when you look at the answers to the question, what I want you to do is answer this for yourself. Circle the one that you believe most fits your regular thinking about your life, okay? So I'm not asking you to give me a Sunday school answer. Don't give me the right answer. You know, don't write Jesus in the blank, because, you know, all the answers in church are always Jesus. Don't put that in the blank. What I want you to do is I want you to circle the answer that describes how you feel or how you look at life when you're sitting in traffic, or when you're sitting in class, Algebra 2, you know, while you're sitting there. Give me the answer that you think of when you're sitting in a doctor's office waiting to find out whether you've got H1N1. And as one of our elders shared with me this week, with the swine flu, and you need the ointment. I know, it's really bad. Delivered poorly, right? Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so here we go. You got them? Well, let's put the answers up here one at a time. First answer. Mostly chance. My life is mostly chance. Is that how you view your life? The circumstances of your life are pretty random. Mostly chance. Second one. Mostly choice. Mostly choice. My life happens the way it happens primarily because of the choices that I or other people make. So chance, random, choice, kind of I'm guiding it, the people around me are guiding it. The third one, letter C, is mostly made up. And what I mean by that is that you really, in many ways, kind of have bought into the idea that life is not really that real, that circumstances are not really that tangible, that life is kind of happening in your mind. And it's primarily in your head. Now, you may say, well, I don't know where that comes from. Well, about half the world's population coming from Hindu background, that's what they believe, that none of what here is reality, is really reality. It's all what's happening in your head, and that's made its way primarily into most of the motivational communication that's taking place in motivational seminars today. It's kind of part of the New Age religious movement today, that most of this is kind of in my head. It's just kind of made up. It's not really real. And then letter number four is, my life is an orchestrated redemptive story. My life is an orchestrated redemptive story. In other words, there's somebody who's orchestrating my life to bring meaning. It's being redeemed. It has value, and it's part of a bigger story, a bigger plan. So which one of those, not your Sunday school answer, but which one of those would you circle right now and say, this is primarily how I think about my life? Chance, choice, made up, or an orchestrated redemptive story? Now, as you're thinking about that, I really would love for you to commit to this. You know, go ahead and circle it on your outline there. And then turn to the book of Acts. We're in Acts chapter 21, and we're going to spend some time looking at Paul's story today, because this section talks about Paul's story, and we see it from the writer Luke as he puts together the events and explains the story of Paul's life. And we're going to see that Paul truly viewed his life, every aspect of his life, as part of a story that God was working out and telling through him. So every piece of his life had meaning. It wasn't just the spiritual moments that had meaning. It wasn't just the moments when he was consciously aware that had meaning. It was all of his life, and all of the events of his life were working together. And one of the things I'll just tell you guys right off the bat is I think in Christianity, we've far too long have we focused on the, quote, God moments or the spiritual moments and failed to understand that if Jesus Christ came to die for your life, it includes the whole thing. Not just momentary excursions into spirituality, but your whole life is part of the story of God. So as we look at this together, picking up where we left off before, okay, where we left off before was Paul was going to Jerusalem, even though everybody warned him not to go. When he gets to Jerusalem, he tries hard to connect with the Orthodox religious community by performing one of the Jewish rituals. In the process of that, rumor breaks out. There's a big fight that takes place in the temple. They grab Paul. They begin to beat him up. The Roman soldiers run down, and they carry him off, and that's where we landed. Now, last week, I showed you a couple pictures of a model of the temple. Let me put the first one up here again. Shows the temple area with the Holy of Holies and the holy place in the center, but that whole area is the temple court. Now, the riots taking place in the temple court, they're yelling to one another, they're beating Paul up, they've locked up the doors to the middle section, that middle part, the Holy of Holies, or in the holy place, and right outside the temple, on your right on the screen, is four towers. That represents the fortress of Antonia. You can see it better in this next picture. The Romans built that there because there were so many riots that took place in the temple area. Can you imagine that? A riot in worship? Some of you guys are saying, you know, some of the Middle Eastern religious people, kind of they get real fanatical about their beliefs and they kill each other. Been going on for a long time, okay? So the Romans built that fortress there so they could see into what was happening in the temple. The Roman centurion and the guards come running down in there. They grab Paul. They're carrying him out. And while they're carrying him out, this conversation takes place starting in verse 37 of chapter 21 of Acts. As the soldiers were about to take Paul into the barracks, he asked the commander, "May I say something to you? Do you speak Greek?" Well, duh, he just spoke in Greek. "Do you speak Greek?" he replied. Aren't you the Egyptian who started a revolt and led 4,000 terrorists out into the desert some time ago? Paul answered, I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no ordinary city. Please let me speak to the people. So Paul has history that's going to play into his story. Paul was born in a city where the primary language was Greek, which now gives him an opportunity to speak to the commander of the guard in Greek. Now, he may have thought to himself, I don't know whether where I was born has anything to do with the story of what God's doing in my life. But we're going to learn, first principle is that your history actually does matter, and God will even redeem where you came from and what you learned growing up, and what God has done to prepare you for where you are at today. Notice it says in verse 40, having received the commander's permission, Paul stood on the steps and motioned to the crowd. When they were silent, he said to them in Aramaic. Now, he knew Aramaic because he grew up in Jerusalem, we're going to find out. This crowd of people would have only responded to an Aramaic speaker because that was the language of their nationality. And so he spoke to them in Aramaic. Brothers and fathers, listen now to my defense. When they heard him speak to them in Aramaic, they became very quiet. Then Paul said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city. Under Gamaliel, I was thoroughly trained in the law of our fathers and was just as zealous for God as any of you are today. Now look carefully at what he's saying. He's saying, listen guys, even though I was born in Gentile land, my family moved me to Jerusalem and I was literally raised in this city. The word raised there, or brought up, is the word which implies that the city itself kind of raised me. In other words, he's saying, I'm a child of Jerusalem. Which would have been a very, very significant thing to the people that were there. In other words, he's not saying, I'm not some outsider. I'm one of you guys. His history is playing into it. And then he goes on to say that I was raised and schooled with Gamaliel. Now, Gamaliel was the most prestigious rabbi. That would be like if you were going into the business community and you said, I've got an MBA from Harvard. Like, that's street cred, okay? Credibility. He's saying, I was tutored in the law. I learned the Old Testament law from the most important scribe, Gamaliel. What's Paul doing? Paul's understanding that his history, where he was born, the languages that he learned, the school that he took, all of that that happened before he became a Christian, is all part of the story that God is redeeming and using in his life. In fact, in the next chapter, after the riot breaks out and some things fall apart, we find out that it's even bigger than that. Look what happens in verse 23. As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust in the air, the commander ordered Paul to be taken into the barracks. He directed that he be flogged and questioned in order to find out, why the people were shouting at him like this. In other words, he wasn't tried or convicted yet, but this was their method of extracting information. So you just tie someone up and beat them until they tell you the truth. It says, as they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, this story is filled with irony, by the way. He said, hey, just curious, I was wondering, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? Now, this was a big deal. Watch what happens. When the Roman centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. What are you going to do? He asked. This man is a Roman citizen. The commander went to Paul and asked, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Yes, I am, he answered. The commander said, I had to pay a big price for my citizenship. In other words, he was born a slave, a non-citizen, and he had to pay a big price to become a citizen. Paul says, but I was born a citizen. I'm a citizen by birth. Those who were about to question him withdrew immediately. In other words, all the soldiers that were involved, like they left the room. They didn't want Paul to associate their face with his treatment because to punish a Roman citizen or even put him in chains was a sentence that would have cost them all their jobs and possibly given them the same treatment because Rome took care of its own. Paul just happened to be a Roman citizen. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. Now, all of that to say what? Paul wasn't there when he became a Roman citizen. Like, he was coming down the birth canal. It was his mother and father's doing that gave him his Roman citizenship. Paul didn't cause the family to move to Jerusalem. They moved there on their own. Paul was assigned to Gamaliel. He grew up under him. In other words, all of Paul's history, all the stuff that took place before he became a Christian, God is going to use all of this in his life to communicate the gospel to the Jews and then on to the Romans. And I just wonder, how about you? Like, what's your history? Where were you born? Who are your people? What about your parents and your family? What are the experiences of your childhood? Many of us believe that really God got interested in us the day we asked Jesus to be our Savior. And what we see in Paul's life is that God has been interested in us and in our story from the very beginning. I got a really interesting blast email this week. I usually hate it when people send an email to me and send it out to all their friends and don't copy on it. But it was from a woman that I grew up with. We went to the same high school, went to the same church. And the subject line on the email was, "The best text I've ever received." So naturally, I open it. I'm curious, why would this mother say this is the best text she'd ever received? Well, let me give you a little background on the story. Tammy went to a Christian college. She married a guy. They graduated from a Christian college. She had a degree in elementary education, began to teach. She put him through law school after they were married a couple years. She was pregnant, delivered their first child, 14 months old. Her husband decided that there was another woman he was more interested in, and he left her. So he walked out on mom and daughter. Struggling to figure out what to do, she attached herself to a church and got involved in a ministry and actually pioneered a camp, which today is the largest Christian day camp in the United States. 6,000 children participate in this camp during the course of the summer, where it is a sports camp, it is a fun camp, but it's overtly gospel-centric. In other words, they ensure that the gospel is shared and many, many kids come to Christ. So she is a single mom, is raising a daughter, raises the daughter up until she graduates this year from high school, and the daughter always worked and participated in the camp. And here's the text message she got last week. Her daughter sent her a text message asking, can I have all the colors of the camp shirts? Each team is divided up into different colors. Could I have all the colors? And she texted back, why? And here's what her daughter texted her. They are so cool. I love camp. Mom, I was thinking today in church how if Dad had never been an idiot, then all those babies that I love would probably never come to camp, and camp wouldn't be the same as it is. So you're really cool, and God is cool. Here's a woman that has struggled. Like, God, we were in Bible college together. We married. I thought we did everything right. He walks out on me. I'm by myself. I'm raising a kid. I'm struggling to figure out what to do in ministry. Every day I'm wondering, like, why don't you send me a man to help me raise this child, to make my life meaningful? And gets involved and serves in ministry and receives from her daughter, who also grows up without a father living in the same community, not present in her life, acknowledging that God can even work in the history of a broken marriage and a failure to do something redemptive, to redeem a life and to touch many other lives along the way. I don't know what's in your history. I know I got fired from the first church ministry position that I had. And I can tell you, like, that's one of the worst and best things that have ever happened to me. I don't know what your history is, but God wants to redeem your history because it's part of the story of your life that He's writing, and it's going to play a role in the future as He uses you to minister to other people. So don't view all those parts of your past as simply the history. View those as God's story that he's writing in you. Second thing we see is that God can even write a story into our brokenness and sin. Look at Paul, right? Into our brokenness and sin. Paul's speaking in verse 4, talking to this group of people. Look what he says. He says, I persecuted the followers of this way to their death, arresting both men and women and throwing them into prison. As also the high priest and all the council can testify, I even obtained letters from them to their brothers in Damascus and went there to bring these people as prisoners to Jerusalem to be punished. Notice what Paul's saying. He's saying, I understand, guys, you're mad at me, you're zealous toward me, you're angry about me because you never want to see the traditions of Moses or the God of the sanctuary in any way violated. And I can relate to that because I did the same thing. Paul's talking about when he was the one who was the leader of the persecution, responsible for the death of the first Christian martyr, Stephen, right there in Jerusalem. Paul is thinking about this and he's saying, guys, I can relate to you because my past is filled with this kind of hatred and anger on the religious basis that I justified it on. In fact, in 1 Timothy chapter 1, Paul says, listen, guys, I'm the chief of all sinners. I'm the worst Christian. My past is filled with violence and murder against the very people that I've become now. What Paul is saying is, guys, I'm broken. But what God's doing here is he's using the sin of Paul's past to give him an audience to connect with these people, to touch their lives. One of the biggest fears that I have is that oftentimes when we are delivered from the sin of our past, our tendency is then to turn around and look at all the other people that are living out those sins, and we look down on them as if somehow we're better than them. Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't turn around and take the enlightenment that came from Scripture and use that as a vehicle to look down on people. He actually can now embrace what they're dealing with and embrace what they're going through. Came across an incredible testimony here recently. There's a guy that's part of our church now that's also part of the Celebrate Recovery movement nationwide. And when he was part of that movement early on, he was actually the pastor on a staff in a church, and he struggled with alcohol, and through CR, he was finding victory over alcohol as God was using the principles and the accountability and the relationships and all of the openness in that ministry. And so he was given leadership to that, but deep down in his heart, he was allowing another sin to kind of bubble up. Lust and dissatisfaction in his marriage. He had actually started the process of kind of thinking through how he would leave his wife and move on into another life that would make him happy. Now, that's part of our struggle as people, isn't it? We have this duplicative way of looking at things. We compartmentalize. We get one area of our life going well. We start feeling really good about that. And then oftentimes we plot evil in another part of our life. And he was doing this. And along the way, God just stepped in and really convicted him. And he confessed to his wife what he was thinking and what he was doing. And graciously, she forgave him. And the marriage has been healed. And now they've grown to love each other again. And they've moved forward. But here's what God is doing to redeem his story. Now, when he works with people in CR, he knows what Christian pretenders look like, because he was one of them. He understands how to call people out who are, on the one hand, saying, yeah, I've got it all together, I've got everything under control, but on the other hand, they're hiding these secrets. And so God's taken even the sin and the brokenness of that experience, and he's healed it. And now he's given this guy an ability to speak into people's lives like nobody's business, and particularly Christian pretenders. You say, well, I'm a Christian pretender, and like I really need somebody to speak into my life. Hey, come to CR on Monday night, Celebrate Recovery. We've got a group of people that will love you to health and wholeness by the power of the gospel. And these are people that are struggling well with their hurts, habits, and hang-ups. Paul had his hurts from the past, his sins from the past, and God used those. And God can use the brokenness in our story for good today and for his glory in the future. Third thing we see Paul using as God writes the story is his actual conversion. Look at chapter 22, verse 6. He starts to tell his story to the crowd. He says, "As about noon, as I came near Damascus, suddenly a bright light from heaven flashed around me, and I fell to the ground, and I heard a voice say to me, 'Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? Who are you, Lord?' I ask." And then Saul hears these words, "I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting," he replied. "My companions saw the light, but they did not understand the voice of him who was speaking to me. 'What shall I do, Lord?' I ask." "Get up," the Lord said, "and go to Damascus. There you will be told all that you have been assigned to do. My companions led me by the hand to Damascus because the brilliance of the light had blinded me." As he begins to tell his conversion story, he's got the two elements that ought to be present in every conversion story. The first one is the question, "Who are you, Lord?" He's asking an identity question. Who are you? And Jesus says, "I am Jesus. I'm the one from Nazareth. I'm the one who was crucified." Paul was aware of that. He lived in Jerusalem. "I was the one who was buried." Paul was aware of that. "I was the one who was resurrected." It was that message that Paul was trying to stamp out. And in that moment, he came face to face with Jesus Christ, and he received forgiveness from sin and eternal life. That should be part of everybody's conversion story. If there's never been a time in your life when you've come face to face with Jesus and understood what he did for you and you embrace that, that's the beginning of your spiritual walk. At the same time, Paul asks the second question, and he says, "What do you want me to do?" You see, because if Jesus really is the Son of God, and he really is stepping into your life, he's got something for you. He's got a plan for your life. It's called obedience. He's got something for you to carry out. And so he gives Paul an explanation of what his life is supposed to be about. I would challenge you to ask those same two questions. When you look in the face of Jesus, you ask the question, "Jesus, who are you?" And you're going to find out that he's the Savior of the world. But many of us have never gone beyond that to ask the secondary question, which is, "What do you want to do with my life? What's the story?" For those people who live life as a series of random chance events, you have decided to become a hostage. You live as a prisoner of your circumstances. So when they go up, you're happy, and when they go down, you're cranky. For those of you who've chosen to live by choice, you are a prisoner of your own heart. Because whatever your heart tells you, that's what you've got to do and what you've got to follow. For those of you who live as if things are made up, I don't really know what to say to you. That's just kind of a weird deal, okay? That's a weird deal. Like, I got up this morning, and when my feet hit the ground, the old nasty shag carpet right there is still there. It's there every day. It's somehow, I just can't get in my mind that that's hardwood floor, or that's a cloud or something weird, okay? I'm really concrete, guys, really concrete. For those of you who live that way, then you never really understand what it means to have a meaningful earthly interaction. It's all in the confines of your imagination. What God is calling us to understand is conversion. Is not just conversion of our soul to get us into heaven, but conversion of our lives so that our story has meaning. Each and every part, our history, our brokenness, even our coming to Christ is part of the story that he's writing of our lives. Not only do we see Paul's conversion, but we also see his associations. As he's standing up here talking to this group of people, he's telling his story about how God called him and how he went to Jerusalem and how in Jerusalem he tried to preach, but God told him that he needed to send him to the Gentiles. And that's really all it took. Verse 21, "Then the Lord said to me, 'Go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" In verse 22, the crowd listened to Paul until he said this. "Then they raised their voices and shouted, 'Rid him, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live.' So their basic beef with him was that if you're going to take the blessing of God to the Gentiles, we want you dead. Now that is religious blindness on their part. Unfortunately, Christendom has retaliated against that throughout history. It created a lot of anti-Semitism, which is opposite of where Paul is coming from. Paul's deal is, I love these people, regardless if they were hard-hearted to the gospel at any point along the way. We need to reach out and love these folks. So then we have the incident that takes place with the Roman guard. And finally, in verse 30, it says, the next day, the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews. He released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. So Paul's standing in front of the Sanhedrin, in front of the council made up of all the religious leaders in the fortress of Antonia there. They're having this conversation. And I'm going to skip the next part, but go back and read it because it's really amazing, the interplay with the high priest. But look at verse 6. It says, then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees, and others, Pharisees. He called out in the Sanhedrin. Now, the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection. The Pharisees do. He says, my brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and I stand on trial because of my hope of the resurrection of the dead. When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. We find nothing wrong with this man, they said. What if an angel or a spirit has spoken to him? The dispute became so violent. Now, this is between them, almost like Democrats and Republicans, you know, in Congress. They're so violent between each other that it says that the commander was afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, listen, take courage, Paul. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. Paul plays upon the fact that he's a Pharisee to divide the council. The divided council cannot bring a legitimate charge against Paul, and so therefore, he will go to Rome as a prisoner that appeals to Caesar, but he will not go as someone who's been convicted of a crime. And his association with the Pharisees, as interesting and as weird as this is, kept him from being treated as a criminal, which prepared the way for him to talk to government officials and for him to talk to the highest people in the Roman court. All of this came about because of his associations. I would say to you, don't count out your connections. Hey, so you were a biker and you came to Christ. Bikers need Jesus. Or you were a banker and you came to Christ. Bankers need Jesus. Don't immediately assume that your secular life and all the people that you've connected with over the years, that has no meaning in your story. There are people that you can reconnect with through social networking from high school that need to hear the gospel, from college that need to hear the gospel, people from work associations that you can build back into their lives that you can reconnect with. There are even people that God is going to use from your past that will help you along the way in telling his story, his redemptive story of your life. Don't marginalize relationships. You need to maximize the relationships that God gave you. See your life as a story orchestrated by God, redemptive in nature. He's redeeming those relationships. He brought you in with those people for a purpose. And finally, we see with Paul that God's writing his story through his relationships and his circumstances. So basically, you know, these guys are just livid about Paul, and they're trying to get rid of him. It says in verse 12, chapter 23, the next morning the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. That's pretty desperate, okay? You got about 3 days with no water. Don't pull it off within 3 days. You're in big trouble. So more than 40 men were involved in this plot. Terrorism didn't start in the 20th and 21st century. It was going on for a long time before that. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets here." So there's an ambush set up. He said, "But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul." So here we have Paul's nephew finds out about this secret society, this pact, and what does he do? He goes and tells Paul, and the rest of the chapter talks about how Paul sends him to the centurion. The centurion takes him to the commander. The commander says, "Well, we'll see about that," puts together a big army, and at night runs him up to Caesarea, puts him under the governance of another leader, and completely foils the plot. And when we get to heaven, one of the things I'm going to want to know is, whatever happened to the 40 guys? Like, how many days before that oath that they took was allegorically interpreted? Like, I won't eat a lot until Paul dies. Or, you know, I won't eat, dessert, or whatever. You know, won't drink red wine or whatever they thought was cool. I don't know. I mean, I just wonder. Or if they really did starve to death. But the tables get turned here, and they get turned because God uses this insider relationship and these circumstances to move Paul. Now, what's the goal? The goal is God's moving him to where? He's moving him to Rome, right? And this is going to move him away from Jerusalem and move him one step closer to Rome. God is working in his relationships and his circumstances. This week I read about a lady who went to the mission field as a missionary, and when she got there, the place where she was at was pretty primitive conditions. It was pretty hard, and she was primarily able to live there and work among the peoples there because every month her supporters from the States would send her a check. And life on the mission field was hard, and one by one, all of the missionaries that were there, they either lost support or they lost heart or they lost health, and they all just disappeared. So it was just her by herself serving there in the mission field. And it was really, really difficult. But she would survive and kind of get along and do what she needed to do. And then she came down with this really, really severe illness. So bad that she had difficulty making her way from the village to the town where the mail came to go to the post office to pick up her monthly check. But since that's what she lived on, she had some people from the area help her. They made the trail there. When they got there, she opened her post office box and it was empty. There was no letter. There was no check. She asked the postal service there, you know, what happened, and they essentially said, "We haven't received anything for you." So dejected, she made her way back to her hut in the village, and all she had for the next month was rice and condensed canned milk, and she rationed it out over the course of the month. And in the midst of this illness, she survived on these meager rations day after day, and by the end of the month, she was feeling significantly better, and she went back, and when she got back to the mail post office, there was not one letter, there were two letters in there. It was the check from last month and the check for this month, and the people said, "We're sorry, we got it in the mail late," and so forth. So she now had the money, but she'd gone a month with hardly anything to eat. So she came back to the States a number of years later. She was reporting to a church about her time there, and she was talking about the good things, and then she was talking about the bad things, and she shared that there was one particular period in her stay, a month-long period where she felt like she was totally abandoned by all the people from the States that had sent her and by God himself, and described her illness, described the check not being there, described her diet of rice and canned condensed milk. After the speaking was over, a doctor came up to her and he said, "Ma'am, can you describe again the symptoms of what you were having?" And she described the symptoms. And he said, "Had you come into my office here in the States, I would not have really had any kind of medicine to prescribe for you, but what I would have prescribed for you is that you would eat a meager diet of plain rice and condensed milk until your body got through this, and that's what I would have prescribed." And suddenly she realized, in the darkest circumstances of her life, at least what she thought, There was the good hand of a blessed God giving her exactly what she needed. Exactly what she needed. Do you believe that your life is a story orchestrated by an all-wise, loving God who's working out his plan, and that all these things that are happening to you, your unemployment, the struggle you're having with your teenager, the relationship that you're having at work, the frustration you're having with your health, the sins of your past, the brokenness of your past, the associations that God's put in your life, the people that God's wrapped around you, that this is all part of an incredible redemptive story. That when Jesus Christ died to pay for your sins, he didn't just come to give you a ticket to heaven. He came to give you a life. And he's writing a story of your life today. If you took the quiz, what would you say? Would it be chance? Would it be choice? Would it be made up? Or would it be, it is written. God's writing a story, and you're part of it. The way you answer that question will define what you do with your life. Let's bow our heads.